The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 24 years ago, a poet came through Yellow Springs. She had been invited to some events at Antioch College, and she was a friend of a member of the faculty at Antioch at the time, Professor Ann Fillmeyer. Her name is Michelle Gibbs, and at the time we did this interview, she was living in Oaxaca, Mexico, as an expatriate, and I believe she still lives there. And she read some poems and gave a very powerful interview that day, 24 years ago. And her poems were in a collection called Riffin' to a Maroon Tune. Here's Michelle Gibbs on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And today, joining us in studio is Michelle Gibbs. Michelle is a poet, a painter, a carver. She really does it all when it comes to creating things, beautiful things. And she's here to talk to us about poetry and whatever else strikes her fancy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Vic. It's interesting for me to be back in the United States, a place that I only visit these days, which I haven't lived in since leaving Detroit, my city of choice, for Grenada in 1980. So it's always interesting to be back here among like-minded people.
Now, why did you decide that you didn't want to stay in the United States?
Well, let me begin at the beginning. One of the things we shared before coming on the air was our common roots on the south side of Chicago. For me, a product, an only child of what was then called an interracial marriage, on top of being a red diaper baby, I found in my early growing years that I, by some historical accident or otherwise, found myself in a totally hostile environment, and a lot of my conscious efforts have not only been to transform that negativity, but to rise above it in a personal way, and that meant changing my geographic location. Maybe I can make a poetic response, which is also autobiographical. I'm a child of rent parties, poker, and potato salad nights, lead belly and bird on the box, steaming tamales on the street, and inside, body heat. The beat of cards slapped down, bottle caps, the pot, raked in, a break called, and dancing set to begin. Of hot debates and grand reunions when the Chicago vets from Spain would gather at our place and the great Paul Robeson would put me on his lap and the rumble from his laugh filled me from within. Of intrusions at all hours from the feds, 'cause we were Reds. Of times when the sight of my face was enough for bosses to show my mom the gate. No nigger lovers here. So I grew and knew from early in the thick of it about barbarity, the kick officially sanctioned, the hate we were faced with. What it meant to have thin skin, a luxury beyond our condition. And above all, the hope within our circle, warmed in struggle, in love and trouble, reaching out across the rubble, that those like us, with a just cause, could win. So that gives you some indication of my early formation and the very embattled community that I was a part of, I was born into, and which produced the examples of humanity which continue to nurture me to this moment.
Michelle Gibbs. Was that from Riffin' to a Maroon tune?
That's exactly what it was from.
Now, what's a maroon?
It is more than a color. Maroon refers to the first autonomous communities of escaped slaves in the Americas. Some of the most famous maroon communities are Jalapa in Mexico, actually the site of the first maroon rebellion that established an independent state headed by Yanga, a famous maroon leader, and of course Palmares in Brazil, which is probably more well known by students of that particular history. It is a collective name applied also not only to the communities but to those Africans who escaped bondage and the living examples they became of successful resistance and maintaining ancestral value structures and perspectives in the context of hemispheric domination.
Now, you refer
to... I should also say that for me, it's not simply an historical tradition, but it is a living tradition which continues, although variously submerged by the mass media, but continues to this moment.
Michelle Gibbs. Michelle, what brings you to Yellow Springs? What on earth are you doing here in the heartland?
Well, you know, they say truth is always stranger than fiction. I have been at Antioch before, but a long time ago. The first time was around 1968, in the, what some people refer to as the college's halcyon days of principled and continuous commitment and creativity. Then again in 1975, when Antioch was the site of the founding conference on socialist feminism, in which I ran my mouth. but since 75, I've had zero contact with the institution, with the exception of meeting a very exceptional woman who teaches here, Ann Fillemeyer. We were both at a writer's retreat in Seattle, actually off of the coast of Seattle, Whidbey Island, Hedgebrook, very interesting alternative institution for women who need space and time and privacy and nurturing to make something of their own. We met there and as a result became fast friends, and she decided I needed to come here.
You referred to being a red diaper baby. Does that mean you had like a hammer and sickle stamped on the back of your diaper? What exactly are you referring to?
It's the colloquial term for children born of parents in the Communist Party. No hammer and sickle. Actually, my parents were dissidents in the party. My father left the party. My father, who was black, left the Communist Party in 1956, not as a result of the Khrushchev disclosures, but rather Aimé Césaire's letter of resignation to the leader of the French Communist Party as a result of the Communist Party's role, very compromising role, in the anti-colonial movements in Africa. So my mother left the Communist Party for very much more personal reasons, but there are also economic reasons rather than ideological. We could not make a living. Simple as that. She could not get a job, and so she was forced to make that accommodation in order for us to be able to survive. But the red diaper refers to those who started out as revolutionary socialists.
In that poem, I think you also make a reference to what is known as the Lincoln Brigade.
My father was a member of the Lincoln Brigade, which was the group of international volunteers who attempted to stop fascism. Some later said prematurely, when I, although that seems to be a contradiction to me, when it began to rear its head in Spain with Franco's reversal of the Republican victory there. He and most of the male members of my family participated in that war, and particularly for the black participants in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, it shaped their future expectations of what was possible, what true equality meant, what comradeship meant, what it meant to be valued for your contribution without any further questions asked. It was a tremendously world-changing experience for those who participated in it, even though they did not win.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 24 years to an interview I did with a poet named Michelle Gibbs as we get into April and National Poetry Month on 91.3 WYSO, introducing you to your new favorite song, and we'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did 24 years ago with a poet named Michelle Gibbs.
What was it like to grow up in the 50s with parents who were members of the Communist Party at the height of the Red Scare, so to speak, and the McCarthyism and all that stuff going on? What was that like for you? Was that a pretty intense experience, or do you really even remember it?
Yes, I spent a lot of time trying to forget it, but unfortunately, it's burned too deeply in there. Maybe I can answer that quickly by reading another poem. This is called Tapping Roots and is about me and my family. It starts at the end rather than the beginning and goes back. I am not cold by nature, but was forced to be that way again with an anger like dry ice when I heard my mother at 72 shot and killed, her breath spliced by an unknown youth who thought whatever she resisted giving him was worth her life. As he fled, she bled to death on the walkway to her home in a manner becoming normal in the USA today. He, too lost in soul to know what she held fast to was not property, but dignity, hers and his too. Everything he threw away, like the gun in his run for safety. Only a week before recovering from a stroke, she spoke so. Oh, you know me, dear, I'm a survivor. There was no way she would go from this earth of her own free will. There was too much still to do. As a Russian Jew, her childhood knew life on the cindered sidewalks of Chicago's Halsted Street, the stopping place for those in flight from the terror of the Tsarist night. Then, too, her fight was for the right to roam free, finish public school, fashion for herself the tools to give the lie to any who regarded her a fool. And when in her teens she followed elder sister Lillian's league and joined Chicago's Young Communist League, no word of caution, danger, might her mother, Fanny, plead that my mom, Paula, would heed. She knew what she was made to do. So in 1930, too, when she met my father, Ted, a black man from Texas whose path had led from there across the nation to Seattle's docks, where the shockwave of a general strike carried him into the party's ranks, took him through organizer's school, and sent him to Chicago to pool his strength with others in the grueling task of mobilizing the Depression's unemployed mass. They found each other in the fray. When work required holding cops at bay to stay evictions, the order of the day for millions who then, like now, turned gray seeing their lives dumped in the street that way. 1936, the war in Spain, and Ted Gibbs, along with uncles, cousin, comrades, enlisted in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, 3 years in which the women carried on alone at home. The men returned, scarred inside and out, for the time unable to rout the fascist terror which grew in clout till it convulsed the world. Paula, still, knew what she was about. She married Ted as profits fed the war machine and American racism kept nerves razor keen. No matter. They weren't invincible, but knew no other way to live than by their principles. Red-baited, blacklisted, they worked, struggled, loved, kept faith, existed. By my birth in 46, post-war America, which is to get back to your question, opened a new bag of tricks called containment abroad. Chicago's version was the Red Squad. So livid were police to see we three together and at liberty, they'd run their cars right up on the curb and back us up against the wall when we refused to be perturbed. Feds at the door and cops on the beat. That was the school of the streets we knew. Risk everything, say nothing, and keep your cool. Saying little, and it was not only McCarthy, but it was an Emmett Till time. Now, some of your listeners I know are probably quite young and they don't know who Emmett Till was. He was a black man from Chicago, a youth who, in a moment of thinking that he was actually a man on a visit back south to the other part of his family, happened to whistle at a white woman and got lynched for his trouble. So saying little in that Emmett Till time, my father, who was also married to a white woman, my father worked. Electrician, carpenter, plumber, gardener, cook, breadwinner, guardian against the beast of degradation beating on our door. He'd take a storefront and create a home, carve a garden from an alley, coax grass up through stone, work his long-limbed artist fingers to the bone so the leavings we were allowed to live in shone with the light of love. He was a painter of scenes, his life a song from a soul bound to take a stand, to say this and that were wrong, fashioned from a longing to be free. This legacy he passed on to me. When finally he died from too much pressure, grieving, beatings, which never did bend his back or tan his hide, Paula continued on her own. She didn't mind, she said, being alone. It gave her time to think. It was 1960 by then, and my turn to join the fight. Paula would wink and say, you know, you can get killed that way, although she said a ken gehalgetveld, which is Yiddish for the same phrase. I'd laugh, agree, and do just what their lives had taught to me, buoying me up and giving me eyes to see the connections between us commitment weaves. Well, she kept going, and I did too. For the next 20 years, we saw it through from Watts to Birmingham, Detroit, Philadelphia, Vietnam, years of uninterrupted war, not just the McCarthy period, until I chose a farther shore and made that my home. She saw me off, wished me well, and remained to battle barbarity's swell in the belly of the beast. She said, remember, Michelle. Sounds like every mother. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing well. That's how she was. In death, the same, refusing to give in, disdaining, tame, standing firm, despite the cost. So in these times of decay, when it's hard to see the light of day, not to mention victory, may their spirits abide, always soar free, and not be lost to history. That is a long way of saying that the surrounding barbarity, as awful as it was not as strong as the bonds of solidarity and humanity that were built within our community. And it's something, those bonds are what sustained me, rather than any bogus identification with a nation state that never took our interests into consideration from day one.
Michelle Gibbs, from her book, Riffin' to a Maroon Tune. Your mother was murdered on the street.
Yes. She was actually murdered right in front of her door, Venice, California, by someone who popped up from the bushes and probably pointed a gun and said, "Your money or your life," and she started to give him a lecture. So that was that.
So you were born into a culture in the town owned by the boss, Mayor Daley.
That's
Chicago,
right.
Illinois, where you were really the ultimate outsider. You had parents who had a marriage that society frowned upon. Your dad was black. Your mom was Jewish. The ultimate outsider, yeah.
The ultimate outsider... only if we accept the received definitions of those in power. Actually, I'm in the mainstream of two of the longest traditions in the world. So
there.
Who's outside of what? I don't know.
Michelle Gibbs has joined us. Michelle is a poet, a painter, a carver. Michelle, before we get into this thing in Grenada 20 years ago, I'd love to hear you talk about some of the other creative things that you do. You just showed me some photographs of some of your artwork, and you really do some amazing things.
Well, thank you. One of the only limitations that radio has is that we have to use our imaginations to talk about the visual. Let me say this. My father was a frustrated artist. In his era, it was highly unusual for anyone outside of a very elite establishment to pursue a career with any degree of success in the visual arts. He gave me a piece of advice. He said, "Michelle, you have talent for this. If you are fortunate enough to go on to university and get someone else to pay for it, please do not study art. The talent will be there when you need it. Study something that will help you feed yourself." So I took him very literally, and I was trained as a writer, and I did a doctorate in American studies, and I was a political activist, and I followed a path that was socially responsible, but instrumentally... not truly satisfying for me. When I was about 30, I had one of those conversations with myself that went something like, "Well, these are all the things you can do and are told you should be doing, but you know you are this other thing over here, which is a visual artist." So I started again in my 30s. It took me 2 years to get back to where I was when I was 14. Technically speaking, and then I had to figure out what I wanted to say as an adult. Since leaving the United States, I think my work visually has grown by leaps and bounds, because the one thing that happened was that I changed from simply being a graphic artist, which is to say drawing in black and white, with the black being the positive and the white being the negative spaces in my work, which is to say a reflection of the reality that I was living, and burst into living color once I moved to the Caribbean, which gets us into your next subject. And also, since moving to southern Mexico, where the energy of the traditions of creation and insight of indigenous peoples have helped to shape my current perspective, I learned to let the material lead me. I learned to work from the inside out rather than imposing your will from the outside in, which also is in Aries is a very important lesson. I learned how to let my context influence me rather than trying to impose on it. So now what I do is, if I'm doing flat work, I use papel amate, which is pressed fig palm bark, the original indigenous medium for recording the codices, their cosmology, used for various religious ceremonies and traditional village gatherings for the last 3,000 years or so. There are two villages in the world that produce this paper, one of them being in Oaxaca, which is where I live. It is a material that is not flattened so much that the memory is removed from it, so that you have the feeling that you're working with something alive. And if you let it, it will speak to you. So I try to do that and merge my concerns with what comes from the memory of the material. And I find that working three-dimensionally in primarily tropical hardwoods, I'm led to do the same thing, to work with the interior forms. And even though my work tends to have a narrative and figurative content, I think it the additional dimension that's provided by the material itself makes it a little richer.
So in the late 70s, you decided to let that artist out again.
Let it out.
And right about the same time, you decided to leave the country. Is there a connection there?
Yes. I thought a certain line of organizing had reached its end, even in Detroit, which during the 70s was probably the only metropolitan area in which there was a citywide, multiracial, principled, socialist, independent movement, which scored a number of victories, both inside the plants in terms of rank and file struggle against the racism of the unions and the corruption of the corporate system, and at the municipal level in terms of reform of the police department, the recorder's court jury system, and electing independent council members at large on a citywide basis. So we were doing all those things, but at the same time, a process of corporate calculated deindustrialization was going on, so that basically the base was taken out from under us. Also, it was very difficult to transform the terms of political debate. Everyone was in this country was very dissatisfied with probably the last statesman that's occupied the presidential office, Jimmy Carter. I don't know if you remember this, but people were going around with T-shirts, ABC, anyone but Carter. Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
You got Reagan. It was clear to me that we were going into an extended period by the end of the 70s of retrenchment, reaction, and as far as our work was considered in Detroit, decline. At the same time, a very hopeful development had occurred in the southeastern Caribbean, the English-speaking Caribbean, in Grenada. And my view has always been that it's important to make calculated decisions about how we use our energy. Strategic intervention is a very important concept for me. And although I am in Aries and I don't really mind banging my head against a stone wall, when you know it won't crumble, and when there is an open window that you can see yourself being invited into, you make the leap. This is what my husband and I did in 1980. We were invited to work with the People's Revolutionary Government in Grenada on their process of social transformation, in part as a result of their awareness of what we were doing in Detroit, and also because we were all part of the same generation, we spoke the same language, we had been formed by the same history, although theirs came from primarily a British context. And so we found that we not only had areas of common in terms of formation, but in terms of goals. We were consciously part of the non-aligned movement, which is another thing that nobody talks about in this country, and had a very sophisticated view as to, you know, like what a rational balance might be in terms of self-sustainable economic development for small nation states, primarily agricultural, and, you know, we could extend that discussion. So we went to work for those reasons, and I found a new voice, a new vision of how my art could be socially responsible, and also, how should I say this? I found a... I was not someone like the generation that Alex Haley produced who was looking for my roots. I went there to do some very specific concrete work. I already had my roots. However, when I got there, my roots discovered me.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 24 years to an interview I did with Michelle Gibbs. I loved that when she talked about going back to Grenada and saying, my roots discovered me. And 20 years ago, I was searching for my roots, and I went to Lithuania. I was there exactly 20 years ago, and I thought I would blend right in because my dad was Lithuanian. And everyone looked at me like, who's this American? Who is this guy? We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, going back 24 years to an interview I did with a poet named Michelle Gibbs. And we're hopping into the Book Nook time machine, and I'm going to ask her a question and send it back 24 years. Michelle, could you read us another poem?
I'll read you another very short poem.
Are you talking about finding other Gibbses down there?
I'm talking about finding the second branch of the triangular trade relative to my father's family.
Michelle Gibbs.
When the cab driver I'd never seen before in Grenada hailed me and said he knew I was a Gibbs because he could tell by looking, I knew I was home, way down there. And when the prime minister of blood my age said, call me Morris, we have plenty for you to do. Let me show you. I said, yes, me brother, way down there. And in the ghetto by the wharf, the beat is Marley way down day, and the youth them working way down day, and the sun is shining way down day. The wind is blowing, the revo growing, and me, I'm going way down day. And I did, and it worked.
Now, I'm trying to remember 20 years ago, Ronald Reagan had just been elected president. I seem to remember...
And nominated in Detroit, if I may interrupt.
Oh my. That's something I'd forgotten.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan was elected president, and I remember early in his first administration, if you read the paper here in the United States, I think there was something in there about a medical school in Grenada that needed to be liberated from some sort of communist regime. Didn't we send in the Marines?
We sent in every uniformed member of the armed forces that the U.S. could find. To be more specific about the context.
What happened?
The Grenada Revolution occurred in mid-March of 1979. It then, because of its very principled stance against the Reagan's Caribbean Basin Initiative, which is an attempt to integrate that region into U.S. hegemonic concerns, it found itself the subject of constant counterinsurgency tactics, destabilization, covert operations. You name it, dirty tricks. The U.S. tried to do everything they could to destabilize the revolution. That went on for 4.5 years. And the Grenadian people managed to resist for that amount of time. Late in that, in the summer of 1983, the internal stresses on the Grenadian Revolution came to a point where there was an internal division of power in the leadership between Maurice Bishop, the prime minister, and Bernard Kohr, the deputy prime minister. That was not resolved in a peaceful manner, with the result that on October 19th, after a general strike in which the Grenadian people, myself included, managed to free Maurice Bishop, Jacqueline Kraft, the Minister of Education and Culture, from house arrest and bring them back into the community, they were summarily executed by the army, which had been mobilized by the opposing forces in Grenada. 24-hour curfew, everything is shut down. Many people, myself included, were arrested by the members of the quote-unquote Revolutionary Council who had taken power. And the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States at that point, which is the diplomatic organization for the English-speaking Caribbean in that region, met and agreed that they would apply economic sanctions, and economic sanctions only, until the Grenadians themselves resolved the crisis. After they took that decision, within a 24-hour period, the United States brought one of their internal security advisors to the meeting. They called the OECS back into session. They pulled Eugenia Charles, who was the prime minister of Dominica, and got them to take the vote over again in order to allow the U.S. to mount a military invasion. The question, why? You're talking about an island of 100,000 people. Their major crop is spices and agriculture. What is the big threat? Reagan needed a quick hit. The U.S. The U.S. forces in Beirut were in a lot of trouble. The U.S. embassy was being bombed. He needed a quick hit. We were it. The U.S. medical school came into play because it was the only thread of international law that they could stand on as a justification for armed military intervention. We have to save American lives. As a result of that, not only the American medical students, but all other non-Grenadian nationals who had been actively working in the Grenadian process were forced to leave the island. Not asked, forced, myself included, roughly a month after the invasion and the occupation took place. That's sketchy, but I hope it gets to fills in some of the blank spots.
It does. And you recently returned for the first time to Grenada?
I just returned this spring after an absence of 17 years. It was terrifically intense and personally affirming and contextually very depressing because the statement that was quoted widely at the time when the U.S. actually succeeded in occupying Grenada by one of the commanding officers from the United States when he arrived was, "Oh, what a lovely piece of real estate." Since then, that has been the governing mindset, so that Grenada, for example, is one of the Caribbean islands which has legitimized economic citizenship. That means if you've got $35,000, you can give it to the government, and you can get a passport with all the privileges that that implies, including tax shelters and
the right to build a condo.
Right. The right to plant the island in concrete.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it looks more like Guam now.
Well, fortunately, it doesn't look like Vieques yet.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Grenada is very mountainous, which is one of the reasons that the former colonial powers had such a difficult time in sustaining their hegemony. Grenada historically went through periodic occupation by all the European powers, and they all had to give up. Mm. It's a very difficult country to subdue, let me put it that way. But the U.S. definitely has control of the southern end of the island, from the airport that they finished building, Point Salina Airport, to the state capital, St. George's. It is, right, I mean, you go through strip malls.
It's funny because a couple hundred years ago, I think the British said the same thing about us, a difficult country to subdue, you know? I mean, what happened? My guest is Michelle Gibbs. Michelle, I'm looking at the clock, and I think maybe we have time for maybe another poem before we have to go along our merry way.
I want to do a very short one and something a little bit longer, which speaks not to the transformations and reorientation one has to go through when one leaves this country, but the culture shock coming back. A short one. Through. When a child, I wrote human and 100-yard dash in the space reserved for race. Of course, they crossed it out. And anyway, black was cool. Later, crossing borders in the 60s back to the United Snakes, for nationality, I wrote Afro-American. That was deleted too. Now, a woman of the world, they can call me what they like in any forked tongue they choose, long as they let me through. Do we have what amount of time do we have?
We've got time for another poem.
Do we?
Is it the Grenada poem?
No, this is a U.S. poem.
We've got time for it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
This is called Back to the Bottom.
Okay.
Strange, having been away after many years out. Sad, returning to continued drought. To see old friends' features all apout amid the folds of flab, others dead or faded to a shade. Buildings gutted and hanging like their gritty dwellers on determination and a thin wire, prey to every twist of the wind in thunderstorm season. This time air on what locals call clear days had me sick each morning for 3 months, body rejecting this pregnancy of accommodation to pollution. Is there a doctor in the house? And whose house could this be, so scabby with neglect? Only an absentee landlord hoarding the take could make any sense out of this or profit from keeping it so. Is there no cure we could effect? Or are we so infected that beggary becomes us? We skate on a thin crust. Trust evaporates in the dust of another demolition. Cracks widen, pustules bubble, corruption crests in all quarters. But yet and still, this period will have its survivors. Surveying the wreckage, shell-shocked victims of a war which won't stop surge garbage cans for something resembling a life that slipped through their stiff fingers long ago, while others dance, demented, down gutted trails left by bulldozers cutting their teeth for the umpteenth time on the land, leaving rubble where neighborhoods used to be. In the gray of a September morning, already thick with chicken grease and diesel fuel, an old woman rises on swollen legs from the doorway where she spent the night, straightening what is left of skirt, wig, will to walk on. Yes, there will be survivors, people who have gotten used to living with no love, no light, no rights worth speaking of, pure grit alone taking them from here to there, the next stop, still in the middle of nowhere. They are the one-time bomb America spends nothing on. Now, when the fuse of their patience finally burns down to the nub of nothing left to lose, and their blues tune turns hot, when the tight tether breaks and their street corner stagger, swagger, and sway becomes a march pointing the way. That's a day to do more than pray for, and I hope we all will.
Michelle Gibbs, riffing to a maroon tune. You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Michelle, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, and I look forward to more.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Our first program of April. It's National Poetry Month, and that was Michelle Gibbs, recorded 24 years ago. And she read a number of selections from her poetry collection, Riffin' to a Maroon Tune. And we have a little extra time on the program this morning, and I want to share a poem that I discovered recently in a new collection by Ann Pearson Weiss. It's called Which Way Was North? And this is sort of the title poem, in a way. It's called Due North. The new gadgets were eagerly purchased at the dealerships by old men brought up on the land who, if blindfolded and spun around in circles, could still say which way was north. These black egg-shaped devices mounted atop dashboards that showed which direction you were going, due east, due west, or somewhere else, the red needle shimmying in the no-man's land of hatch marks between the four true compass points. My grandfather was such a man, raised on a farm and a Rock County landowner himself, in favor of frequent drives to detect small differences in the progress of neighbors' cornfields, or to inspect hail damage after a summer storm. He had no need of a compass, but one year, when I was young, we got off the plane from New York City to find him tickled with this new invention, compact ovoid proof that technology was advancing in the right direction. On the way home from the airport, with me in the front passenger seat, he made a number of unnecessary turns to show us how it worked. Pointing a finger, he instructed, "Watch it now, see? Now we're going south. Don't that beat all?" It's long been known that redundant information, if delivered in novel form, is welcome. But it's only recently that we have learned how to install microchips in our cars, our phones, our pets, the flesh of our own arms, and track ourselves and our possessions all over the planet by satellite. It is only now that we have invented a world that frees us from the need to know which way is north. Thinking back to those drives with my grandfather, along blacktops so narrow that they were nearly overhung by green light-stippled leaves of corn, and down white gravel roads blinding as sun that gave off great ghosts of dust as we passed, I realized that his delight was never in the compass itself, but rather in knowing more than the compass. He'd show me how he could beat it again and again, taking turn after turn and calling out east northeast or south southwest before the needless red needle could find its way there. I love that poem. Ann Pearson Weiss from her new collection, Which Way Was North? And don't miss the Book Nook tomorrow, when my guest will be Keith O'Brien. 10:30 Sunday morning. Put this on your calendar. We've all heard about the new betting scandal in baseball with the superstar Shohei Ohtani and his former translator with the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we're all wondering what's going on with this. And we're all remembering a betting scandal from many years ago with the superstar for the Cincinnati Reds, Pete Rose, the player manager. Well, Keith O'Brien grew up in Cincinnati, and he did extensive interviews with Pete Rose, and his new book about Pete Rose and the rise and fall, the tragedy, the Greek tragedy of Pete Rose, who probably should be in the Hall of Fame, but he couldn't admit that he gambled on baseball, and he kept lying about it. And he had it bad. And Keith O'Brien interviewed a number of friends of Pete Rose, guys who would place his bets, guys who would pay off his bets or collect his winnings. And he was getting cooperation from Pete Rose, but After doing a number of interviews with him, Pete decided he wasn't going to talk to him anymore. And we're going to bring you that interview with Keith O'Brien, which was recorded before the Shohei Ohtani betting scandal. So we don't mention it during the interview because it hadn't happened yet. The book wasn't out yet. So that's my excuse. Pete Rose had excuses for years, didn't he, for not admitting the truth? Well, now, if you pay extra when he signs your baseball, he'll admit that he lied about betting on baseball. That's tomorrow morning at 10:30, Charlie Hustle with Keith O'Brien on the Book Nook right here on WYSO.